This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. From 2005 to 2008, the price of food rose 80%. And in 2008, the ranks of the hungry increased by 250 million in a single year. What caused this? In 2003, there were about $13 billion in global commodities index holdings. By 2008, though, more than $300 billion had poured into commodities index holdings, significantly upsetting a market as relatively small and sensitive as the wheat market. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Frederick Kaufman, author and a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, who will explain how these very complex financial instruments called commodities index funds help to create an inordinate amount of human suffering while upturning traditional ideas and concepts of supply and demand. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Frederick Kaufman. He's a professor of English at the City University of New York and the school's Graduate School of Journalism. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and his recent piece that came out in the July Harper's Magazine is entitled The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Fred.
Thank you, Alex.
Why don't you first start out telling our listeners a little bit of the genesis of this article, The Food Bubble. You've also written, I should mention, books such as American Stomach, A Short History of the American Stomach, which is a fascinating read I recommend to our listeners. So you've obviously been writing about food in many different ways. This is a little different. This is kind of a confluence of business reporting and food reporting, right?
Yes. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago attending a conference about the rising prices of food. I don't know, maybe some of your listeners remember that, you know, 2008 you were paying more for a quart of milk or for some chicken or your dozen eggs. The price was actually going through the roof. And there was a conference in Washington, D.C. to try to understand why the prices of grain, why the prices of all the inputs in our for our weekly grocery list were going so high up. And I was listening to these endless speeches, very boring speeches for the most part, about agriculture. And that's one of the problems with this issue is so much of this is so arcane and so bizarre and so inside the beltway in its own way that people, I think, have just kind of given up on understanding how agricultural markets work, the general public. But anyway, there I was listening to this. And between all of the speeches, people would kind of sidle up to me and they say, what are you doing here? And I tell them I was interested in the rising food prices. And they would say, well, you know, I've heard a rumor that the wheat market has been cornered. And as a journalist, that really stopped me short because that is a huge story. And of course, what does it mean to corner a market? This is the classic behavior of Gilded Age monopolists, which is you try to control as much of a single commodity as possible, be it gold or silver or milk or cheese or gasoline, and by holding it and as much as possible driving the price up. And I thought, is somebody actually cornering the market in wheat? And if that were the case, this would definitely be worth a lot of investigation.
And what conclusions did you draw in your piece, The Food Bubble?
Well, I discovered something really odd, which was that the market, the wheat market, was acting as though it were cornered, even though nobody was actually cornering it. And that was the strangest and most counterintuitive finding that I came to, is that for some reason, something had entered the dynamics of this market that was making it act in this bizarre way, driving this bubble and, in effect, subverting and destroying the American wheat market, which, of course, has vast effects on the global wheat market. So let's also talk about what we know happened in 2008 in terms of global wheat and global grain, which wasn't a fact, in effect, that it went through the roof, that there were food riots in more than 30 countries, riots which left dozens of people dead. In America, too, we saw unprecedented numbers of food insecure. We saw 49 million hungry families in America. We saw 1 in 5 kids in America on food stamps. We saw 1 million hungry people in Los Angeles. There were devastating effects to the rising cost of wheat. And so I was thinking to myself, what is behind this? What is driving this unbelievable bubble in wheat? And so I started investigating the most widely exported form of wheat on the American continent. In other words, the wheat that sets the global price. And what I discovered is that there are actually, there's not just one wheat, there are a number of wheats. Some traded in Chicago and Chicago Mercantile Exchange, some traded on the Kansas City Board of Trade. But the most widely exported wheat from the American continent is a form of wheat called Hard Red Spring. And that is traded exclusively on this obscure syndicate out of Minnesota called the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. And so I actually went to Minneapolis and I talked to the CEO of the Grain Exchange and I talked to a lot of people who worked there because something very odd had happened to the price of Hard Red Spring in 2008, which is that Hard Red Spring usually trades for between $3 to $6 per 60-pound bushel. There was a run from about 2005 to 2008 in which the price of Hard Red Spring doubled. And then it doubled again, and then it doubled again. It hit $12, $15, it topped $20. And finally, on February 25th, 2008, the price of a Hard Red Spring wheat future ended the day at over $25 per bushel, more than about 10 times its normal price. And this sent world markets into a tizzy. This had devastating effects.
So there's many different types of wheat and this Hard Red Spring that all of a sudden shot up. Can you walk us back a little bit to the history of wheat production worldwide?
Yeah, I think one of the most important elements of wheat production worldwide is the stabilization of the price of wheat, because wheat is a real thing. It grows out of the ground. And so therefore, when people bring their wheat to the market, when farmers bring their wheat to the market, as it turns out, they all kind of bring it around the same time, just as all the rice growers in Japan used to bring their rice to the market at the same time, and the wheat and the corn, it grows and it's ready, it comes to the market. What happens when tons, millions of tons of wheat all hit the market at the same time is the price plummets. It just goes right down in classic supply and demand fashion. When there's an overabundance of supply, when it's going to last you the whole year, then the price goes down. And then, of course, later on in the year, as the supply dwindles, the price shoots up. Well, this is no good. It is no good because we need wheat all year round. We need it every day. And it's not just a matter of you and I, Alex, and people who buy the bread, but it's the manufacturers of the bread. There are very large capitalist interests who have a very big stake in a stable price of wheat. We're talking about Cargill, we're talking about Sara Lee and Domino's Pizza, people who have very large stakes in wheat markets and need to manage their risks and price that wheat 9-10 months in advance, okay? So that's the basis for the need to stabilize the price. And one of the most brilliant things about the development of the American futures markets in grain is that they have allowed that price of wheat to go on a general downward arc since 1903. Since 1903, for more than 100 years, the price of wheat, the real price of wheat, has steadily gone down. And this has been a great thing for our country. This is part of what made the 20th century the American century, is that the wheat price was stable, people could afford food, food was relatively cheap, and the dollar is relatively strong. Okay, this is a wonderful thing, and it allows for all sorts of economic development. Well, how did this happen? How do these markets work? Well, I'm not going to go into brain-numbing detail here, but the bottom line is that there are two kinds traditionally in the wheat markets. There are two kinds of participants. One are called the bona fide hedgers. Those are the people who actually have a stake in wheat, who actually create wheat like farmers, or store wheat like the warehousemen, or they buy wheat like, once again, Sara Lee or Domino's Pizza. And those people need to buy and sell their wheat on these markets, and they benefit from a stable price. On the other hand, there are speculators in this market. Now, a lot of people think, oh, the speculators were to blame. Speculators are not necessarily a bad thing. Speculators are people who want to make money on the day-to-day rise and fall of the price of wheat. So in other words, what they're doing is when they see the price as being a little bit low, they buy. And then as it rises, they sell. That's it. And those speculators are welcome to the market because they traditionally are said to provide liquidity to the market. So because the speculators are buying and selling wheat. That allows the bona fide hedgers to sell and buy as much wheat as they want, whenever they want. The key to both of these participants in the market is that they have to take sell positions for every buy and buy positions for every sell. That's the beauty of the futures market. What a futures contract is simply a promise to either buy or to sell wheat at some point in the future.
Soon we shall be covered by wheat.
Did you say wheat?
Wheat.
Wheat. I'm dead. They're talking about wheat.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Now back to my discussion with Frederick Kaufman, author and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine.
I was surprised to learn in your piece the commodities market had traditionally been a very stable one and not a volatile one. So why don't you tell us a little bit how this new form of trade, this was in the 90s, so everybody's trading volatility, the delta. That was not the case for most of the 20th century in the commodities markets, right? Can you tell us how that evolved and some people may say devolved?
Well, people make money, brokers make money when the price of a commodity or of anything fluctuates, when it goes up, when it goes down, when it does so erratically. Some people are going to make money and some people are going to lose money. And generally, it's the professionals who make the money and are able to anticipate the movements of the market. That's the idea of trading volatility. Of course, there's slight changes in wheat markets all the time, and this is what allows speculators to stay in the business. However, the grand arc of these futures contracts have generally been stable for about 100 years. Now, by the 90s, a lot of the international commodity traders were actually getting out of these markets. They found that they were not making enough money on these markets. They found that there wasn't enough movement in these markets. This was around the time that Goldman Sachs came up with the Commodity Index Fund, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index Fund. And what it was the idea of a mathematical formula like any index, such as the Dow Jones or the S&P 500. It was an index of the prices of a number of commodities, some of them in energy, some of them in livestock, and some of them in agriculture. And so what they came up with was a mathematical formula so that you can invest in one number and stick your money in that one number and watch your money grow.
But these futures, I thought that just similar to stocks, you need to find, in terms of the futures markets, you need to find a buyer for every seller. So for every short position, there needs to be a comparable long position, correct? But in this case, we found that we were skipping ahead a little bit, but the markets, everyone started going long on this, which is one of the...
Okay, the conventional wisdom of futures markets, and all the financial professionals I talk to and all the traders I talk to, one of their great dogmas is, for every short, there's a long, for every long, there's a short. And this short and long, this is all, sometimes this is confusing to people, it's very simple. When you go short, you say, I'm going short, that's simply a promise to sell wheat at some future date. And when you go long, that simply means you're promising to buy wheat at a future date. So in other words, for every sell promise, there's a promise to buy. For every short, there's a long, and a long, there's a short. And that's why these things cancel each other out five times a year. And that's why what Goldman Sachs came up with in 1991 was so radically different. Because a commodity index fund, well, the idea was to allow a different kind of investor to enter this market. Not a speculator and not a bona fide hedger, but a very deep-pocketed investor. We're talking about hedge funds, we're talking about state pension funds, and we are also talking about sovereign wealth funds. In other words, huge pockets of capital looking for a place to sit for a long period of time, maybe 15-year window, maybe 20-year window. And they could sit that money in the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index and supposedly over the years, watch that index go up. There's only one problem. As that index goes up, what that means is the price of food is going up. And so their investment is actually making our daily bread less and less affordable. That, of course, didn't necessarily occur to the people at Goldman because that was not their focus. Their interest is not actually in the commodity market. They have different interests. Their interests are making money for themselves. And this commodity index fund turned out to be a great way, not only for Goldman Sachs, but for all the banks that imitated them to make a lot of money. And in fact, everybody likes to talk about Goldman Sachs as a villain, but this was JP Morgan Chase, this was Lehman Brothers, this was AIG. Everybody out there realizing there is money to be made in commodity index funds, forgetting that these funds and the rising value of it would have a devastating effect on real people throughout the world.
As the bubble started to burst in 2008, you say, quote, the ranks of the hungry had increased by 250 million in a single year, the most abysmal increase in all of human history. So how did we get to that point?
The key here is that whenever you talk to people about commodities, they'll say, well, I know why there was a food bubble in 2008. It's biofuels. In other words, it's the federally mandated acreage for corn that put a real crimp in the wheat acreage and sent the price up. Or other people will tell you, no, it was the drought in Australia. And other people will say, oh, in fact, it was the flooding in Kazakhstan. And all of these things contributed to a problem with the supply of wheat. However, the wheat harvest of 2008 was the greatest wheat harvest in world history. There has never been a year where there has been more wheat harvested in the world. Now, that does not mean there was a perception. There was a perception of a problem in the supply lines. But added to that perception was this unbelievable and unprecedented interference in the basic guts of how this market was working. And that was done by these large banking conglomerates. And this is the interference. This is what happened, is that, as I was explaining, for every buy, there's supposed to be a sell. Well, what Goldman did, and everybody followed, is that they would take these long positions in the wheat market. In other words, they'd say, okay, we're going to promise to buy a lot of wheat when this contract is up. Today, there are second and third generation commodity index funds, which take into account the short side of things. But at the beginning, the idea was, if we want to collect and amass a huge pool of capital, the best way to do it is to go long only. That way, we can simply collect money, put it into one particular kind of position on these markets, and then continue to grow that position, to make that position larger and larger and larger as time goes on. So in fact, five times a year, whenever those contracts would come up, which would be the time, logical time, for these large banking entities to sell, they wouldn't sell. What they would do is they would take all that stuff that they were holding, all those long promises to buy, and they would do something called roll it over. They would do a rollover. So they would just say, okay, we're not going to buy it now. We'll buy it in the next contract. And they'd roll their position over. Plus, at the same time, since they had more money pouring in, they would buy a lot more of these promises to buy. And so they amassed this huge, unprecedented collection of promises to buy. And it actually began to unsteady the market so that actually, at a certain time, these positions, these long-only promises to buy, there are more of these made by banks and speculators than there was actual wheat in the market. In other words, they overpowered the actual amount of wheat, and they overpowered the number of actual and bona fide hedgers in the market. There's one more step which is really essential here, and that's really understanding how reprehensible the bankers acted in this case. Because while they were actively destroying and setting out of whack these markets, guess what? They had protected their positions outside those markets through this really diabolical process called replication. People don't understand how the bankers do their business. So let's say, Alex, you give me $100 to invest in a commodity index fund, right? Because you want to get in on this commodity bubble and make some money, right? Because the price of wheat's going up 84%. Isn't that great? So you give me $100. Fred, invest this for me. Well, what should I do? What I should do is I should take that $100 and invest that in commodity index funds. But I don't have to. All I really need to do is take 5% as a good faith deposit, and that will hold that $100 position on the commodity market, such as in Chicago or in Kansas City. So really all I've done, Alex, you give me $100, but I've put down five. So now I'm holding 95 of your dollars. So imagine if instead of $100, it's 100 million or 100 billion, $317 billion. So what do they do with 95% of that money? Well, no fools they. They put it in the most conservative investment possible. They sink most of it in United States Treasury bills. Okay, so now they have all this money, hundreds of billion dollars in T-bills. Well, once you have a lot of money in T-bills, what can you
leverage
do with
it?
Well, yeah, you got it. You leverage that hundreds of billions into trillions, and then you take those trillions of dollars and you give it to your day traders, your brilliant mathematical day traders, and you say, guys, take the most lucrative investment, take the most lucrative positions you can do day by day, hour by hour, and make us a lot of money. It was extraordinary how much money they made on the backs of a billion starving people. I mean, this is serious what happened. The numbers of people on the earth for the first time in 2008, not only the percentages, but the real numbers of hungry people ratcheted up in unison. And for the first time in world history, we had more than a billion people on earth in a position of food insecurity, the most abysmal figure in the history, in human history. And that is what allowed the bankers to make billions of dollars. Simple, straightforward human suffering.
The crops, the grains, fields of rippling wheat. Wheat, all there is in life is wheat. Oh, wheat, lots of wheat, fields of wheat, a tremendous amount of wheat.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest today is Harper's Magazine contributing editor Frederick Kaufman. His recent piece in Harper's Magazine is entitled The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. So let's get back to the bubble bursting.
What happened in 2008 is that there were so many losses in so many other parts of the economy that people actually had to take out money from commodity index funds to cover losses in other parts of their business. At the same time, they came to realize that, in fact, because of this constant counterintuitive buying into strength, that when they actually looked at how much money they had made, that they hadn't made very much. In fact, a lot of these commodity index funds had made a tremendous amount of money for the banks that were offering them through management fees, through replication, but the people who were actually putting their money in them lost money.
The comparisons to the subprime mess that we're still feeling the reverberations from are pretty stark.
Well, we're going to feel, let me tell you something, Alex, we are going to feel reverberations from this food bubble that are even starker, because guess what? We are seeing food volatility today. We have yet to really see the effects of the flooding in Pakistan. It looks as though they probably are not going to get their crops in. The drought in Russia, the fires in Russia, the export bans in Russia, these are going to be huge factors, and this is why the UN has called for their special meeting on the 24th of September to discuss specifically global speculation in commodities and global supply, because this is really just the beginning of what could be tough going in the future in these major commodity markets, particularly food markets.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Harper's Magazine contributing editor Fred Kaufman. Fred, what are some of the solutions to this problem that you highlight so well in your piece, The Food Bubble, in Harper's Magazine in July?
Well, I think that when we see the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN meet on September 24th, I think that one of the big issues is going to be this push towards free-flowing and liquid globalized grain markets. In other words, no more import-export bans like we're seeing in Russia right now. Free flow, no more side deals. I just saw today that Russia had made a side deal with Kazakhstan to import like 500 million bushels, this sort of thing. The only valid solution has got to be the International Grain Reserve. It's got to be, and it can be a farmer-owned reserve. It's got to be real wheat stepping in when you have this price volatility. And we're going to see a lot more price volatility going forward. I don't think there's any question that with the drought flood cycles that we see based on what is now a fairly obvious climate change situation, we're gonna be seeing a real variety in wheat harvest, particularly in the area around the Baltic Sea, which is becoming an increasingly important wheat growing area. But traditionally, those harvests are erratic. And so we're going to need to really fight very hard to figure out what are new stabilizing forces and to bring all those stabilizing forces to bear. Now that the futures markets have been hijacked and could easily be hijacked again. I mean, the futures, global futures markets used to be this great stabilizing force. Now they've been hijacked. So we have to try to get back to and use any other kind of stabilizing force possible. And it's very hard to keep Wall Street out of the food business. Because when I talk to, for instance, some of the bankers, and I say, what if people just disallow you and they make a law, the federal government says, no more bankers in the food business. They laugh at this. They literally scoff at the ideas of regulators getting them out of this business. Because all they really then have to do is put in a call to their London office and do their trades out of there. Not illegal in London. They're multinational.
Right. So we can't simply just say, well, this is the Clinton administration's fault. And maybe it was at the time, but the cat is out of the bag. And these entities are global, and one country making a change to, let's say, restoring the Glass-Steagall Act, et cetera, that's not actually going to put these cats back in their bag, so to speak, correct?
Cargill does business in hundreds of countries. They do business in hundreds of countries. I mean, forget about their tax problems. Who's going to regulate them? How can we regulate a company like this? And, of course, food is increasingly this globalized international phenomena with China making land grabs in Africa, and it's totally interrelated. The markets and the futures markets are completely interrelated. You cannot buy and sell real or fictional wheat anywhere in the world without having an effect on real or fictional wheat everywhere in the world. And so, once again, we have to get back to the real.
What could the SEC have done back in 91 when the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index was first being traded to try to stymie this food bubble?
The CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, never should have granted exemptions to Wall Street banks, which was done in the mid-90s. That just should not have happened. That was an outrage.
And as we've seen in the last 8 years, having EPA people from coal and oil extraction companies, a lot of these people who are running these government organizations are coming from the industry. So a lot of these scenarios are kind of the fox guarding the hen house, so to speak, right?
If you look at the people at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, if you look at the chairman of the board, you will find a high-ranking executive from Cargill. And in fact, just last year, the Minneapolis Grain Exchange went private. These guys are going to make a lot of money for themselves due to the regulations, due to the federal mandates that all trades be be relegated to exchanges. Places like the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, these obscure syndicates, will all of a sudden find themselves the beneficiaries of being the place and the clearinghouse, not for 10 or 20 new exchange-traded funds, but they have just retrofitted their entire operation, so they're able to handle 50,000 exchange-traded funds. That's the future, Alex.
Frederick Kaufman, contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. His article appeared in the July Harper's Magazine called The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. His website is AmericanStomach.com. Fred, thanks so much for being our guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Boogaloo Joe Jones, Boys from County Nashville, and The Bobs. SeaChange Radio is made possible by support from Kuva Coffee Company, Bounty Growing System, Sungevity Solar Home Specialists, and Invisible Structures, a sustainable paving company. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to SeaChange Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For SeaChange Radio, I'm Alex Wise.